Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kourula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake up, Hollywood. This is your host with the most, Nikki Kourula. We have a legend in the studio today. Legendary producer, executive producer, engineer extraordinaire, Mr. Ken Kallay. Say hello, Ken. How are you?
Hey, Nikki. I'm great. How's everybody doing?
Our studio audience loves you already. See? So we were talking right before we started this interview. You said you grew up in San Jose, right?
I did.
How long did you live there?
I lived there all my life.
So did you get into music in San Jose?
I did. I was actually going to be a lawyer. I went to college to be a lawyer, and I decided it would be smart to do some scouting and investigating. So I got a job in a law office my senior year of college, and I hated it.
You're like, this is not the life.
I said, I am out of here. And right about then, pot swept San Jose, and I fell in love with music, and I was trying to impress some girl. I sort of learned to play guitar, and
it's not always starts, right?
Yeah. God bless the women, you know. So yeah, I learned to play guitar, and then the pot kicked in, and then I wanted to record everything I could, and I went and tried to get a couple jobs up in the only studios in the area, and they were pathetic. I mean, they weren't as good as the gear you got right here.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Small rooms, no gear. Well, yeah. There was probably not much of a scene there, right?
There wasn't. So I said, okay, all there is our attorneys and accountants in San Jose. I decided to move to L.A. and get a job. My master plan was I was going to get a job in a recording studio. By that time, I had written like 30 songs.
Wow. So you were singing and playing. Wow.
So, yeah.
And who was like a major influence? Like
Steely Dan.
Oh, awesome. You know. Yeah.
Crosby, Stills. You know, Our House, that was an amazing song.
Love that song.
Yeah.
My friend that lives next door to the house that inspired that song, apparently. Oh. Crazy.
Yeah. So I fell in love with the whole business. We drove down to L.A. and got a job.
And you were in the folk scene, essentially. Like, that was the era, right? That was
right.
Kind of like, what year was that when you moved to L.A.?
70.
Wow. That was, like, the perfect time to be in the city.
Exactly.
This is like Laurel Canyon, extraordinary.
Right. I remember seeing David Crosby walking down the street with, I think it was Joni Mitchell.
What?
You know, but these people were walking on Sunset, just hanging out.
And you're like, this is the right vibe.
Right. We went to the Troubadour, there was... Linda Ronstadt in the bar with...
the Eagles, right?
The Eagles, yeah.
Yeah. That was her backing band, right?
Yeah.
That is so wild. And were you intimidated by that scene, or was it kind of super inspiring, just like make you want to play and write more?
What do you think?
I'm sure it just made you want to play more.
Exactly.
And collaborate.
So inspired.
Yeah.
And so I got a job. I got a job in this recording studio, at Wally Heider Recording, and... their big thing was they did live recording, which I wanted to get into the studios where they made albums, like Capitol, RCA, things like that.
Yeah.
But nobody wanted to hire me. Of course, I didn't have any experience, just a little bit of home recording on a little reel-to-reel. So I got a job at Wally Heider's, and my first job was working with Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
What?
As a second engineer.
Seriously?
Yep.
See, that wasn't on your bio.
So I sat there I sat there and I realized in about one day that I was crap. And I mean, these guys were truly artists and musicians. Their songs were spectacular. I didn't even know what a chorus was or something, you know.
But, I mean, that's tough company just to be around to see that.
Right.
With your first taste in L.A., right. You know.
But I saw them make these sounds, and I saw the engineer, Bill Halverson, dial up these amazing sounds, and the speakers, these big speakers, were singing.
Right.
You know, and it was like, that's what I want to do. I knew right then that's what I wanted to do.
Wow. And did you, like, learn from anybody like Tom Dowd? Did you read up on any of those guys? Because he's, like, one of my heroes, Tom Dowd.
No, I just worked, but I worked behind Bill Halverson,
okay,
and Rick Pekonen, who was he engineered War and these guys, and I would sit there and take notes. Chris Huston, who did these amazing, he was a British guy, so all these people were making great records, and I sat behind them, and I just stole ideas from them.
Wow, you like know? What was the one thing that you were like, I've never done that before?
How to mic a guitar, two mics, how to stereo mic it, you know, how to mic drums. You know, what you do with I worked with Fifth Dimension, and Bones Howe was the engineer on that, and there Wally Heiders had these racks of high-pass, low-pass filters, and it was like 24 of them on there. Why would you have 24?
Right.
High-pass, low-pass. And Bones Howe said, I'm always going to, he put in 70 hertz filters on every track.
That's crazy.
And like 70, because he said, I said, why would you do that? That's, you know, I love the bottom. He says, well, one time I was at a party and somebody played my record and they had a subwoofer and I had all this boom stuff. I was so embarrassed. So he says, never again. I'm controlling 70 hertz. I mean, he wouldn't do that with a bass. The bass track probably be, you know, filtered at 40 hertz.
Wow.
But.
Wild.
So I thought, I mean, I would never have I decided not to have a firm rule about that. You know, I wanted as much fidelity as I could.
And then were you just like kind of being tossed around from one party to the next? Because that whole scene was just one vibrant party after another. You had Elton John, Mama Cass, you know, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Hendrix. You had the Beatles coming through town.
Yeah, I wasn't much of a party guy. I just sat in the studio.
Wow. And what studios were you in the most?
Wally Heiders.
Okay.
So what Wally Heider did is, their specialty was they had recording, live remote trucks. So what I didn't realize when I wanted to work at Capitol, RCA, all these other big places, was that I'm going to take forever to get to work with a good artist. Whereas Wally Heider went out and did these remotes. And so they started sending me out to do remotes. And then the band would actually come back. Wally would give them a real good deal if they would come back and work in the studio.
Hmm.
So then I'd work with them on the stage, and then they'd come back in the studio.
So it was like familiar.
It was like brilliant.
And who are some of the bands that you worked with? Do you remember?
Oh, yeah. I mean, McCartney.
I'm wearing the shirt. I'm wearing the white shirt. I saw that on your bio.
Yeah. Joni Mitchell. I mean, I did the live album, Miles of Owls. That was my thing to do.
You did some Frank Sinatra, I saw, too. Was that live?
Yeah, but that was later. No, that was like remixing. But back then it was like It Always Rains and Never Rains in Southern California. I cut the original track of that one.
Wow.
And I mean, I don't know if I can remember everything, but I happened to do a lot of things, and I did a lot of polka. Wally Heider didn't That's let crazy. Me have an opportunity, so Ken, go use this, go record this polka band. But you know, I did that, and literally I did this polka band, and I would put the kick drum right up in their face. It was rock and roll.
Wow.
And the polka guy was going, I am bad.
You know? So, well, but it's great to learn a different style, too, because it teaches you
it
how to
matter.
Adapt a little bit.
Right.
Yeah.
I learned how to mic an accordion.
Wow.
You know, and it was killer. And that was my thing, is I loved to get a sound on something that was unbelievable. I didn't care if I had to tape a mic to the accordion or whatever we had to do.
Did you have a favorite reel of tape that you use?
Usually Scotch 3M.
I've got Scotch. Yeah, that's what I've done a couple records on. Scotch 250.
Right.
That's the best.
I didn't like Ampex.
Right.
Because it shed. We almost lost Rumors.
Wow.
On Ampex.
And did you also do like a lot of the splicing? Like you did a lot of the cuts?
I am.
No.
My nickname. Yeah, no.
Oh, you did.
My nickname was Cutlass.
Wow.
I mean, we would. We had so many edits in a 24-track tape that when it was running, when we were rewinding it, it would just go when it went past the head, it would pop, 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 pop.
Wow.
But we would edit the hell out of it.
And then you
recorded. And that wasn't my idea. It was like usually Lindsey Buckingham would say, okay, let's take this section here and cut it up to this section. This take it was better on take one on from the verses, and we'll put those into here, and we'll take the choruses from take 21 maybe. So we just
did that ever stress you out, or were you just like, yeah, I can do this, no problem?
It stressed me out early on. I remember I did Steve Martin comedy album, and I did not necessarily Soap. That was Procter and Bergman, this comedy group, and I had to edit these. Can we have a bigger laugh, please? Can we have a bigger laugh? And I used to get so tired. You know, why don't you take the laugh that you had? You know,
right?
But I would cut these things, and they would have me cut all these things, and I would have the pieces of tape that we wanted to put in there, or the word we wanted to put
it's
in.
Like hanging.
Hanging, you know.
Right.
And I remember one time one of those guys pulled out a joint, and I thought, I smoked regularly, but this was high octane. And next thing I looked at those pieces of tape, and it's like,
you're like, what have I got myself into? This is a jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah.
So you worked with Fleetwood Mac on one of their live recordings, right? Talk to me about that.
Yeah. So one day I got the call that I got known to be a kind of a cocky rock and roll engineer, and I used a lot of EQ and I went for a lot of aggressive sounds, and the studio called and they said Fleetwood Mac wants you to, well, Fleetwood Mac has just recorded a radio show called King Biscuit Flower Hour, and they want you. We want you to mix it. I said, I want to go out with my girlfriend. And one of the guys that worked there at the studio, he said, no, Calais, you know, this will be the biggest mistake you make.
Wow.
You know, go buy this album and listen to the new White album, Fleetwood Mac. And I would take it if I were you. So I did. And, you know, changed everything.
And then you walk into a studio with them. They ask you to be the producer of Rumors, right?
Hell no.
So tell me how that came about.
I walked in. I was just going to be the engineer for the day. So, in fact, I had bought this record, the White Album, and on the back cover was the picture of the band, but they didn't care how they put the names. So it was like Stevie and Lindsey's were reversed under their picture. So when Stevie walked in, I went, Lindsey, big fan. She goes, I'm Stevie, thanks.
You're like, oh, shit, fail.
Yeah, I'm out of here now. But other than that, it was a Saturday. I remember Richard Dasher was their right-hand man, and he was their co-producer. And he came in, and one of us said, want to smoke a joint? And it was like, I just remember it was a beautiful day outside, and it was a beautiful day inside. We started mixing the radio show, and by the time we got to Rhiannon, I mean, we were all buddies, and Stevie Nicks was twirling and doing her thing. And she go, Ken, can you add some more fairy dust? And I go, sure, Stevie. And I turn it off. And she go, thank you.
That's
but it was
awesome.
Just one of those magical days that everything worked right, and they loved me, and I loved them. And the following day, they had to mix booked time at the record plant to remix the radio single for Rhiannon. Back then, we always had to remix a single for an album cut to make it more aggressive on radio.
Yeah, more
shorter.
Compressed. Yeah, right, right.
And so they had already hired this guy, and so they were going, Ken, we already hired him. We're going to go do the mix of a single. But I wish it was you, and, you know, we'll miss you, and blah, blah, blah. So I figured, easy come, easy go. And the next day was a Sunday, and they called me Sunday night, and I said, Ken, it didn't go well at all. The engineer was completely overwhelmed by the Fleetwood Mac, and they were because it went so easy with me, and I was comfortable, they were kind of going, what's wrong? What's wrong with you? To this guy, and he was just sweating bullets. or his equipment didn't work. He said that his computers, they were just starting to do automation on mixes, and he said the automation didn't work. So he had to resort to manual, which is what I was doing for the whole radio show.
Wow.
Was moving it, you know.
But you were well-versed at that point. So it was like,
yeah. That's what I did.
Yeah.
So they called me back, and they said, come over. Can we remix the radio show, the single, at Wally Hyder's, where we did it, the radio show the day before? And I said, yeah. Piece of cake. I already done it. No pressure. It was like a home run. You know, it was a grand slam. So they, Stevie once again twirling, and everybody loved it. So they take me down the street and they go, you know, we're about to do this record, a new record, following the follow up to the Fleetwood Mac record, and we were going to hire this guy yesterday, but he flopped. And would you like to do the record?
And you're like, yeah.
I go,
But you probably still, they didn't really win you over right away as far as, like, who they were as a band yet, right? Because this record was really what put them on top.
Right. I mean, Rhiannon was impressive.
Right, of course.
And, you know, so, and I did, I remember the engineer that produced that Fleetwood Mac record was a guy named Keith Olson. He's a brilliant engineer. He liked the softer sound, which probably worked well for Stevie and Lindsey and their folk music, but I liked a more edgy sound. So,
right.
So when I got to the single mix, it was supposed to be more edgy anyhow. I just EQ'd the hell out of it.
Wow.
You know, and made it all poppy, and so they loved it. So they said, do you want to come up and we're going to do the record up in Sausalito Record Plant. Would you like to come up and record with us? And I said, maybe. I mean, where am I staying? How long is this going to last? And they said, well, we don't know. We're going to stay up there at a house, and it's going to probably be 3 months.
So you were living with the band?
I was living with the band.
Wow.
So as in my book, I talked about making rumors, right? I talked about me and my dog Scooter drove up in our little Audi, and I'm driving up there, and I'm thinking, living with a bunch of musicians. I wasn't really crazy with the idea.
Yeah, there have been lots of movies about that.
What could possibly go wrong, you know?
Everything.
Right. So, so, I mean, so that's a be a good segue.
And were they writing at the house after they were recording? Was it all happening in the studio?
All happening in the studio.
Wow. Do you remember what the first song that they did, that they tracked?
Yeah, it was called Keep Me There.
Wow.
The Christine would be Dog.
Wow.
So, and Keep Me There was an interesting song because it was like it became a 6-minute song. And at first it was a verse, chorus. And right after the last chorus, there was a breakdown and a bass solo. And it kind of went boom, 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 boom. And then Lindsey did the screaming solo, 3 minutes long or two minutes long, whatever it was. So, but the first part of the song was Christine, really weak vocals, and it was not a terrific song. Mm. It was called Keep Me There, and she's like, love will keep you together, blah, 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 whatever it was. But so we kept pulling this song up, and it was like, the chorus was not really workable. We were trying to figure out how we could rewrite it, but the whole tag out was amazing.
Gave it that lift.
Yeah. So we just kept putting it away, and we went to the next song, and we recorded, you know, we kept recording. So they, you know, after we'd finished one song, we'd go, what do you want to work on next? And one of them would raise their hand, and, well, I just wrote this in the hotel room last night, you know, and where Lindsey said, I want to do the song called Go Your Own Way.
Wow.
So everybody would, okay, so we're going to do this song now. So then everybody would grab their instrument. I mean, in the case of Lindsey would say to the Ray Lindsey, his guitar roadie, can you bring me the Martin acoustic? And then Mick and John would start
work out parts.
Yeah, in the control room, we just sit there. Wow. Lindsey would go chin 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 chin, and then Lindsey was saying, okay, Mick, I'm getting ahead of myself, but on Go Your Own Way, he had a drum part in mind, the drum part similar to the Street Fighting Man on the Rolling Stones. where he wanted Mick to play these toms in the verses.
Yeah.
So that's what would happen. One day I remember Stevie ran in. We had just finished the song, and she said, "Guys, I just wrote this amazing song. It's a hit, I know." And we said, "Okay." And she sat down at the we had a keyboard inside the control room. She sat down and started playing her little three chords, right? And it was Dreams.
Wow, I got chills.
You know, and so this is like hot off the press. She just wrote it, and so Lindsay starts strumming, you know, with it, and Christine's singing harmonies with her, and John's grabbed his bass and started playing stuff, and so basically, and in the control room we had a few instruments out in the studio. We had from left to right, we had the keyboard station, grand piano, and a Leslie B3, an organ, Hammond. And then we had the Lindsey Buckingham's guitar station, which we had like three or four amps and his headphones. And everybody had headphones, and everybody had a talkback mic. And then going around, we had John McVie with a bass, and he stood. His bass was in an amp. His bass amp was in a...
Isolated, right?
Isolated in another room. So he could stand in right in front of Mick and feel the kick drum.
Wow.
Basically, what we tried to do is have the drums be the only thing in the room.
Amazing.
Right. So the Leslie was in it was out in another room also.
And all the singers too, I assume, right? Like, was it recorded live? Like everybody in the room essentially working together?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, we would do a rough pass. We would give somebody a microphone to do a work vocal. So in the case of Dreams, Stevie wanted to do her work vocal while everybody else was playing.
Incredible.
So, and interestingly enough, we never could beat her original work vocal.
Mm.
We tried a number of times, and so if you listen to any one of the versions of the mixes of Dreams, you'll hear at times that when I ride up the vocal when she sings softer or when the band's playing louder, you'll hear this. The drums wash out because there's the leakage of it.
I'm going to play Dreams right now real quick because this is perfect. Here's Dreams, Fleetwood Mac.
What you love.
So good. So good. Man, I mean, I was just picking your brain about how you were doing a lot of these mixes while we were listening to that. But you know what? Tell us a little bit about the process, because this song is just so airy and beautiful, and the sounds and the guitar sounds and the reverbs on the vocals, everything just has such magic to it. Tell us how the process went down to kind of create that master combination.
Well, I mean, it's funny. There's no real, I just happen to like a lot of space. So what I would do is I use every bit of space between the two speakers. And that means I would pan stuff hard left and hard right to leave room for, so there wasn't a lot of intermingling of sounds in the middle, so that what was in the middle was supposed to be in the middle, like the kick and the bass and a vocal, right?
Well, and the other thing, too, it's like what we were talking about. It's like, did you really know that you were creating this sound, that this, you know, record, and really specifically that sound with the marriage between the bass and drums, it created a sound that had never been done like that before. Were you kind of aware of how that came about as it was happening, or was it kind of like an afterthought?
It was just feeling. You know, this song, Dreams, was such a magical feeling. I wanted to put as much space and magic into it and air. Like we worked a lot of times to get the drums real tight. We did a number of takes of this song, and we found that even though Mick is a great drummer, any shifting of time, and it would take you out of the hypnosis stage.
Mm.
So we actually, finally, we had him play, I don't know, 10 different verses. And once we got one that was perfect, we took 4 bars of the verse.
And just looped it?
Just looped it.
What?
So we wanted to basically just have it just be...
like a monotonous,
so
hypnotic.
Right, hypnotic.
Wow.
And then on the hi-hat, I put a phaser on there. So the hi-hat, if you listen, kind of going...
yeah.
And it was just meant to put you in a dream. You know, and the reverb on the vocals and the background, nothing was too aggressive. The acoustics were nice and smooth. Really
everything's airy.
Airy.
Like, every part has headroom.
Right.
Do you remember what the mics you used on the vocals?
On Stevie was a 441 Sennheiser.
Wow.
So the first day, what I usually do with the artists, I set a bunch of mics out, and I have them go down the line and sing. And they find it's a good trick. They'll say, oh, my God, I sound great on this. So that's what we use. And so if they're comfortable, they're going to have a better performance than if I tell them, no, use this, $10,000 mic and,
And you can EQ it the way you want it.
Right.
Amazing.
So it works. In the case of Stevie, she was very suggestible, taken up. She was, if you told her something was wrong, she would think it was,
she'd fly off the handle a little bit.
Well, she would be worse. She'd start having self-doubt.
Right.
So another,
take her off for Zen.
So I learned also, this is a good tip for engineers, I always, I didn't let their, normally people would do a vocal, and afterwards you talk about it, like, how that was pretty good, let's tell her to do this. But the artist is out there in the room watching the people talk.
Right, so they're feeling vulnerable.
She's thinking, I knew it. I screwed up, and they're all talking about it. They found it. So I'm always talking, that was really great. I especially like this part and this part. So I'm always telling people, talk to your artist. Don't let them sit there in silence while you're telling a joke or talking about the sports thing.
Yeah, because it's almost like they're at the most vulnerable in that creative state.
And it's all about me being lazy. If they're vulnerable and they're insecure, and they're gonna go, I didn't do that good, and then you're gonna have to overcome that.
Right.
So I want them 100% in the sort of hypnotized. I want you guys to be feeling so happy about what's going on.
You said something really interesting too. You said you gave everybody their little station on, the board, and kind of let them kind of move the faders up and down for their various parts just to see what balance would work.
Well, that was for mixing.
That's risky.
Well, it wasn't risky because I would turn it on them.
Right.
So the reason we were saying why we did that is there was 24 tracks, and I only had 2 hands, 10 fingers. So I had to each track is basically one volume control. They call it a fader that slides up and down. You guys have all seen that. So we would mark all we would mark the faders where the optimum starting position is, and oftentimes with a record, a radio mix, you need to, nothing is static. You have to ride the vocal. You need to ride things to keep everything to be heard. And so we would assign, when we needed more hands on the board, we would bring in John McVie to ride something, and Mick Fleetwood. So I would normally, I realized after very quick time that I wouldn't give Mick his own drums to control, but I would give him John's bass.
Oh, and so you give them like not their own instruments,
right?
Oh, that's
so
interesting.
So I would give John mixed drums, I give him one fader.
Smart. That's very
smart. So I would do the same with the guitars, and normally Richard and I would take the guitars and the keyboards, but so to prevent somebody from pushing up their own instrument too far and wrecking the mix.
One of the things I love too is like the really delicate balance of the harmonies, because like I love harmonies. That's like one of my favorite things as a singer, as a writer. Like when you have that perfect blend, which you do, how many layers of harmonies are on that? Are there doubles? Are there triples?
Doubles and triples for sure.
Wow. Because you can hear it, but it just doesn't sound like it's crowded. It just sounds like it's just airy, like
sometimes a whisper. Some people don't understand, and you would understand about how microphones work, right?
Right.
I can get closer to this and sound closer.
Right.
Or I can pull back further.
Right.
And there's more air. So sometimes it's good to have an artist, you have them get off the mic a little bit. I build in air. So it's not going to be, because if everything's like this.
And it's static. Right. Amazing.
Yeah.
And you're also doing that with the reverbs too, because when you're bouncing things down,
sure,
you're creating these, you know, nice textured guitar parts. Did you have any problems? Because like, you know, Lindsay plays with his fingers. So that's got to be a little bit different ways of how to mic it, right? Whether if he's playing acoustic or, you know, even how the attack is on the electric. Did you find that you'd have to mic it differently than other artists?
Well, yeah, you always have to listen. And what annoys me about engineers now is they think they can pull up a big compressor on, you know, on a plug-in. And they're pulling up this thing that looks beautiful, like the real thing used to be.
Right.
But I had an engineer the other day. He was pulling up, trying to, and I said, "You need to brighten that up a little bit." And he's like pushing these knobs, and I said, "Wait a minute." I said, "Why don't you get out of the chair and get your ass out and listen to the instrument, see what's going on?" And he actually went out to the instrument, and the guy was playing with his fingers, and the strings were really old. So, next thing you know, we're changing the strings, and you know. That's where it starts. Get out there, you know, be an engineer. That's the most fun thing for an engineer to do is mic an instrument.
Right.
Like, see where the sound's coming from. See if it sounds getting.
So you're thinking like a musician in that moment. You know, you're thinking about how to capture the instrument in the best way possible. A lot of engineers don't always think that way. They're just like, okay, I know I can get this guitar to hit this level at this certain way, and it'll always be something I can count on. But it's like, every player can play the exact same. You can have 12 people playing the same figure. It's always going to sound different. So, like, you're thinking like a musician, even the way you're thinking about capturing it, you know?
Sure. I mean, the instruments is a beautiful thing. We recorded acoustic guitar today, and I had tried a couple different musicians to play the acoustic guitar, and they just weren't hitting, and I wanted silky. I mentioned Bill Howerson. I'm not sure if we were on mic or not. Bill Howerson was the engineer for Crosby Nash.
Yeah.
And I went over, for some reason, onto his website, BillHowerson.com, and on the second or third page, he recorded, while we were doing the Crosby Nash album, he recorded Joni Mitchell, then Graham Nash's girlfriend, playing one of the new songs, For the Roses. And it's such a beautiful sound. He used a Neumann U67,
yep.
And he used a 57, Shure 57 on her vocal. But the guitar is just glass.
Silky.
It's just, you know, and that's what I wanted. I wanted a silky guitar. So the guy playing guitar today, he kept pushing accents, and I said, "No, just hypnotize
me. Easy, yes.
Ching, 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 ching." You know, and I put a lot of top end on it and made it silk, but it makes the song. It has an effect on the song. And if you just go record it anyhow, then you got a problem to deal with down the line.
Right.
When suddenly you're finding, why doesn't that all fit together?
You know, I've been working on the Stevens tape machine that you mixed Rumors on, and I noticed so many little intricacies of the tape machine. You know, even in the 70s, they just made gear sound better. Like, the monitors sounded great. The tape, you know, when you get anything sustained, like a vocal or a guitar, and you're recording it on tape, it has this warmth that digital just lacks, just doesn't have the same thing. So do you sometimes miss that older way of making records and making recordings compared to how fast and compressed it is with digital?
Yes and no, but I mean, you can fight that. I mean, I think I can do the, I can get the sound. I'll record it 96K on Pro Tools, and I'll run all analog gear, everything through there.
Hmm.
So I like adding EQ, and for instance, I put an EQ and a compressor in line before the Pro Tools rig, and my engineers just go, "What are you crazy, old man? You know, you can do this, add it later." No, but you know,
no, get the sound now.
Get it now, and you're two steps ahead of it. Add a little EQ to the voice. Next thing you know, they click one, two. Then they're starting to go, "Hey, this is kind of, I'm going to add two clicks," and then the compressor a little more. They're like getting excited because they're making something really happen, you know, on an instrument. So we're using analog going into a tape machine, I mean, into Pro Tools.
Tell me a little bit about Go Your Own Way. You're working on this track. Like, who came in with the song? How did it come
before about? I forget, can I tell everybody something important?
Oh, please.
Okay, so you asked about the vocals, the vocal blends. So I was doing vocals the other day, and most artists think they can do the harmonies. You do stacking, right? Thirds, fifths, sevenths, whatever it is. But oftentimes when they do this, they're doing a lyric line, maybe a five-word lyric line or a 10-word lyric line in a chorus. If you go and break it down, sometimes their notes are the same as the other people's notes.
Yes.
So what Fleetwood Mac did, what Lindsey Buckingham would do, is he would sit down there and get the piano, write the piano and say, okay, your note, and here's the chord I want, and your note is, you know, B-flat, your note is C, you know, and so everybody had to learn their notes. And when I worked with the Beach Boys one day, and that's what Brian Wilson did. Piano right there, get your vocals.
Wow.
You know, I don't care how good you think you are, get it on a piano, and somebody's making a mistake. And they'll laugh about it. Oh, I was singing that other note. I was singing your note. Sorry. So if you want to get killer vocals, just use the piano.
Well, you map it out that way.
Yeah.
You know?
You want it to be, you know, this ding, 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 ding. And it's a good tip.
Was it ever too much? Were you ever adding too many harmonies? Did you have to take stuff out? Were you like, nah, it's good? Where did you, because I mean, it's so easy to just keep going down the rabbit hole and then just keep indulging and lose sight of like how good it sounds like it does on the record.
Well, a friend of mine told me that the important thing about being a good producer is knowing who to produce. So with Fleetwood Mac, I never had that problem. You know, I might say, well, let's do another harmony. They'll go, come on, Ken.
Like, no, yeah, we're good.
Or they'll try it, and they'll go, yeah, you know, it's not too much. It's too much.
But, so it's a nice balance of both of you guys working together. Everybody right, kind
it of. It takes a team.
Yeah. And it's that balance of
I couldn't have done any of it. After I did the Rumors album, everybody wanted to hire me to do stuff. And I worked with this band, and I thought, okay, just do this. Play this funky, this guitar part. And the guy wasn't Lindsey Buckingham. So he couldn't do it. And a lot of times the people aren't playing on a click. So, you know, if you're all playing without a click, you're
a train wreck.
Yeah, the beats are gonna be off, and you're subliminally, it might sound okay to a normal person, but subliminally it's like it's sliding around here, where's the beat, and it throws you off.
So let's talk a little about Go Your Own Way. Tell me how this song, like, how do you remember how it all went down?
Well, I thought it was a complete disaster when they on the first day that we did the demos. Lindsey said, we asked who's got a song, what are we going to do? And Lindsey said, I got this one song. And he described that he said, Mick, I hear the drums as being something from the Rolling Stones' Street Fighting Man. if you can do that. So eventually we listened to that. But the thing that got me is Lindsay went out and went on mic. All of them went out to the stations, and Lindsay was playing his acoustic guitar, just beating the crap out. I think he broke a couple strings, and he was screaming. The veins in his neck were popping out.
Wow.
He was going, "You can go your own way," and I was like, "What?" He didn't sound anything like, you know.
Right.
Eventually,
you heard all the shitty takes.
Yeah. Eventually, we replaced it with a nice electric guitar that we controlled, and you know, and then Mick figured out the drum pattern, and he couldn't do the Street Fighting Man, but the way Mick did it, Mick's toms are kind of reverse. He goes low, high, mid. The center right. Toms are high mid instead of mid high.
Interesting. But the drums are like one of the key elements of this record. Yeah.
Well,
it sounds so good.
Mick used to always say he learned that if the drums aren't right, the records are not going to go.
Smart man.
So what, another trick we did, we'd record the drums one day and they sounded fabulous. And then we'd record another day and they didn't sound fabulous. And like, what the fuck happened? You know? And, well, Mick tuned them this day, or the drum roadie tuned it. So we started learning that, like everything else, we needed to control it, quality control. So we went out, and Richard Dash, bless his heart, went out and learned to tune the drums, and he tuned the drums every single day.
Wow.
You know, and
so everything was on point.
On point. So everything, we knew what it, we learned the secret. We wanted the top heads more tight than the bottom heads, and they all had they were all at the same pitch.
When did you know you had magic with Go Your Own Way? Because it's one of the most iconic singles off the record.
Well, I mean, the guitar solo made it. And by the time we added all those acoustic guitar parts, I mean, Lindsay was playing a straight rhythm electric, and eventually he decided that the problem was he needed an acoustic guitar to put a beat down, because it was kind of like rambling. So he added this acoustic guitar part, ching, ding, 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 and that was the complete hook. That solidified the song and made everybody wait for that
part.
Gave
it that sparkle.
It gave it the sparkle, yeah.
Well, let's listen to it. This is Fleetwood Mac, Go Your Own Way.
Loving you isn't the right thing to do. How can I ever change things that I feel? If I could, maybe I'd give you my world. How can I, when you won't take it from me? You can go your own way.
I had to give it a little extra of applause because that song is so iconic. It's so crazy how that you know, song to song, this record, it's just a phenomenal masterpiece. I mean, few people get one of those records, and you got two of those records back to back. Now you finished Rumors, you're making Tusk. Tell me what the pressure was like making that record, because I remember you saying you didn't really feel that pressure because you had a long time to work on the songs, make the demos, make the recordings, redo parts. So now you got Tusk, and this record's done super well, Rumors. You're recording Tusk. What was the big obstacle to recreate that or kind of keep moving forward?
This is where Lindsay threw us a real curveball. So we built a brand new studio called The Village in West L.A., spent over $1 million building the equipment and building the studio. We had the best equipment. I mean, it was going to be... So we all walked into the studio to make Rumors 2, is what I thought. And, you know, I got nominated for a Grammy Best Sound, Best Engineered.
Amazing.
I got nominated. And so I thought, I'm going to nail it this time.
And you nailed it the first time, just so you know.
Steely Dan won.
Damn it. Yeah.
But they were my idols.
Right. If you were going to lose to somebody,
that's a good sounding record.
Right.
That was my, I listened to it all the time. But yeah, so we got into Tusk. We thought, we're going to make Rumors too. Lindsay woke up one morning saying, my fans will hate me if I do the same thing again, if I take the easy way out. So he decided somehow, the first day of recording, he walked into the studio with his long, curly hair just scissored off. And it was like a crazy man. He said he just went literally crazy in the shower. He just cut everything out. He cut his Levi's, just tearing at everything. His girlfriend, who happened to like a lot of coke, decided that he should start wearing eye makeup. So he came in being a completely different guy. So the first day that I said, we said, okay, let's work on the song. He's going to get it. He picks his guitar. We said, okay, let's do your Les Paul. That'll be great. We'll put it through the Marshall cabinet. And I mic it with the mics I want to use. And I start doing what I always do. I would EQ it to make it sound as good as possible. And he said, okay, Ken, you happy? I said, yeah, very, that's perfect. He said, okay, now turn all the knobs 180 degrees the other way.
What?
Yep. So this guitar that was just really perky and, you know, vibrant, just all of a sudden went...
All mud.
He says, okay, now let's press record. I said, wait a minute, what are we doing here? I said, I can't record a record by just turning the knobs 180 degrees. I said, are you telling me that you want to have more bottom in this record and emphasize the bottom? He goes, yeah, okay, let's do that. But that's not really what he wanted. He wanted distortion. He wanted everything.
He wanted everything and all the wrong decisions.
Everything bad. So he was determined to make this. He wanted to put himself in a test.
Right.
He wanted to see if he got himself completely out of the comfort zone, if he was smart enough to make a hit record anyhow. So he purposely distorted the vocals, guitars, and everything. And it was just, for me, it was a nightmare.
Wow.
And eventually, he wanted more control and more control, and he built a small studio in his house and took all the tapes home.
Oh, my God.
So we couldn't even work at anything.
That's crazy.
And he would come back and play these songs, and they were just literally meters pinned and just distorted. But knowing on it now, I just wrote this book called Get Tusk, and... after having the...
Available at gettusked.com, right?
Correct. And now having hindsight, and I realized that Lindsay was trying to experiment, and if he was a better communicator, because he wasn't, he could have... And if I was a better communicator, if I was a little more mature then, we would have said, hey, Lindsay, I think I see what you're trying to do. You're trying to really go out, try to create something new. Don't fight us. We're not going to fight you. We'll work with you. Let's try...
But it becomes a battle of egos. It becomes a battle of, it's also in, you know, drugs induced. You know, that changes.
Right. Yeah.
It changes all the variables. Right. You're not having the same variables. You know. Right.
So that's, and he was telling the band, you know, where Lindsay, I know Mick was talking to him, like, Lindsay, he says, the name Fleetwood Mac and the sound of Fleetwood Mac can only support you so far. And if you take us too far out on the limb, the limb's going to break and the, our fans are going to not stick with us. So there was the Mick Fleetwood was old Father Time for us, and he always spoke wisdom and not always, but
most of the time. We'll give him 70% of the time.
But I have to say that after, in hindsight, listening to seeing what he did, he wanted to be so grungy on his songs. And you can hear the tusk, it was really nasty, you know. But if you listen to the girl songs, he did some of his finest guitar work.
It's delicate.
Yeah, and so I kind of thought, well, how did he rationalize that to his, for his fans? Like, I want to be punk and I want to be grunge, but on the girl songs, I'm going to be, you know, unbelievably sweet and clean.
Well, let's listen to, this is Tusk by Fleetwood Mac off the Tusk record. So real quick, we just had to play an abridged version. Tell people real quick where people can get your book. We're running a little bit out of time. I know you've been working with your daughter, too, Colby. You've done a couple of her records.
Yep.
You know, Colby opened up for me at the House of Blues a long time ago. This must have been 2006.
That was when she was just starting.
Yeah. So I think it was. I think she told me it was her first big show.
Right.
It was. I think it was with another band called Bixby, And yeah, that was the first time we played together. We played together long time ago.
That was her first big show.
And she was awesome. Yeah. I mean, she sounded like a combination of Lauryn Hill and acoustic soul artist.
You know, her vocal was so pure. It was. She could just quiet a room. I remember we did one show at the hotel cafe, I think, and she went on at 11. It was her first show, and the management was there. Labels were there to see her, and everybody's like partying and throwing drinks and like just loud. And I got up on the PA and I turned her voice loud, right? And everybody, the whole place, again, it kind of makes me teary. The whole place is silenced, and they went shh, and this voice was just angelic.
That's amazing.
It was amazing. So,
you working on another record with her?
No, she's working on with her new band now called Gone West, and they're a four piece, four singers. They're all do harmonies, and it's country. Very cool.
Awesome.
I call it very bendy vocals, you know.
Well, Ken, we're going to have you come back because we are running out of time right now. But, man, what a treat it was to interview you about your life and making these records. We hope to hear many more records from you in the future. You and I should maybe collaborate, too.
Yeah,
would be pretty happy.
Still working.
All right, man.
MakingRumors.com.
Yep.
GetTusk.com.
MakingRumors.com. GetTusk.com. Pick up these books today. They're great for the holidays. And we'll see you guys next week.